Morning. It is 7:05, and we are in room 124 in Juneau, Alaska, and this is the Community and Regional Affairs meeting. This morning, we are having a work session as a committee so that we can discuss and ask questions on the CS for House Joint Resolution Number 30. This is disapproving the Local Boundary Commission's recommendation regarding the annexation of territory to the Juneau-Ketchikan Borough, and it's brought to us by Representative Thomas. I did invite both Representative Thomas and Representative Johansson, who the areas affect, but Representative Johansson is out of town and won't be in until 12 noon today, and I believe Representative Thomas is sending a staff person to see the questions that are raised of the committee. Representative Sisna is on our way. Joining us this morning, though, at the table is Representative Dahlstrom, co-chair Gabriel Ledoux, and myself, Representative Fairclough. With that, we had several issues that were raised before us during public hearing when we heard this bill the first time. I believe that was last Tuesday. Yes, I'm getting a nod that that was when. And so we wanted to invite the Local Boundary Commission down to give us an explanation on how they arrived at their decision, as well as talk about forestry receipts and how education is going to be affected by that. So committee members will have questions, but do we have a representative from the Local Boundary Commission here?
Yes, ma'am.
To present? If you'd come to the mic and say your name for the record. For the committee, we do have Peter Chappell Davis online for questions, Scott Brandt Erickson online for questions, Ketchikan City lawyer, and then Peter was from Hyder, and Bob Blasco is a maybe. I'm not sure. We're not taking public hearing, but if there are people that we have questions of as committee members, I just want you to be aware that those individuals are online should you have questions. Sir, your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Lynn Crystal, and I'm with the Local Boundary Commission representing a judicial district out of Valdez.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, in a nutshell, what I wouldn't want to paraphrase for anyone else, but what we heard is there's a money grab going on, and that the Local Boundary Commission is giving Ketchikan a whole lot of income and leaving the community unable to fund education. And so one thing that I'd like to hear is sort of the criteria, not sort of, exactly the criteria that the Boundary Commission uses to measure their decisions.
Okay, you know, first of all, we start with the Constitution, the state Constitution, and then we go on to state regulations, state law, and then we go on to our own regulations. And so the issue of the Forest Service receipts, being as that's a very transitory funding, we don't know whether that's going to continue or not. As of right this moment, it's not. It's been sunsetted. So whether it'll be picked back up again, you know, who knows. So we don't put a tremendous amount of worth on that just because of the fact that it is transitory, and so we're looking for the borough situation is a long-term situation. It's not a short-term, and so we're looking for things that would be more likely in the vein of taxes and that type of thing that would be more ongoing.
We have been joined by Representative Newman. Thank you, Representative Newman. Representative Ledoux.
Would it be legally possible under the current laws to approve annexation but make annexation contingent on the actual end of forest receipts?
Wow, that's a big question. I don't know. We do have a representative from the AG's office that could probably answer that, but I certainly wouldn't have an answer to that. I just don't know.
Representative Ledoux?
Or in the alternative, permit annexation, but not include, make it with an exception so that as long as forest receipts continue, that the monies go to where they were, that they don't come to the new, to the Ketchikan mm-hmm. Borough. I'd like to hear from somebody, perhaps after you've given your presentation or answered the questions that other members want answered. I'd like to know if there's somebody who could answer those questions.
If I might, as the chair, does the committee want to have everyone up front, or do we want to hear from individuals one at a time and then bring up everyone for a group discussion? So what's your preference? Representative Ledoux.
I actually think that it might be easier to have everybody up front and kind of like a working group.
Could those who want to participate, could you just raise your hand so I see the number? Forestry, law, so three. Representative Salmon usually sits here, but I have one chair right here. If we could move him forward. Yeah, I can get two here and then maybe a second person up. Do you understand what I'm saying at the table so that we're on mics? Sally, you may be called from the back anyway, but who knows?
Okay, I got a good view right here.
Okay. So for those of you listening at home, we're playing Find a Seat right now at a microphone. Representative Cisna is going to be there, so I can only have one person at each end. You're welcome to join me. I don't think Representative Olson is going to be here if you want to try this seat. Or maybe, actually, let's take Salmon, Representative Salmon, up one more. There we go. Welcome. just for our committee now, if we could go around the room, since we're situated, if we could get names of those here so that we can start a discussion.
I'm Margie Vandor with the Department of Law.
And Lynn Crystal with the Local Boundary Commission.
I'm Jean McFerrin. I'm with the Department of Commerce, serving as staff to the Local Boundary Commission.
Bill Rolfson, employee of the Department of Commerce, Division of Community and Regional Affairs.
Welcome. So we're going to try to make it round table, but if you have a question or comment, if you'd raise your hand, then I'll nod so that I have you in the queue. And we typically run under Mason's rules of order as far as chairmanship and committee process goes. So I'll just nod, and then you'll know that you're in the queue, and I'll call you up. And committee members will have priority in asking questions and being able to follow up to get their questions answered. Is that good for committee members? Thank you. Representative Ledoux, you had a question for the Department of Law.
Would you like me to repeat
if
the questions?
Yes, I believe there were two, so.
Yes. Yes, the first one was, could you approve annexation under the current statute but make the approval contingent upon the disappearance of forestry receipts? And then the second question was, could you approve annexation but carve out an exception for the forestry receipts so that the forestry receipts, I mean, Ketchikan can annex the property, but they wouldn't get the forestry receipts, that the forestry receipts would continue going to where they were going previously.
Through the chair. Number one, the forestry receipts program is governed by federal law, and so the recipients are determined by federal law. The fact that the LBC is able, actually under statute, to do contingencies on petitions for annexation now that the statute changed since the earlier annexation attempt, I believe we would have to get some approval from the federal government that the territory would still be considered to be in the unorganized borough for it to go to the other communities. But once it's in an organized borough, I believe the federal law treats it differently than the fact that it's currently in the unorganized borough. And I might like to defer to Mr. Rolfson on that, because this is a program he lives with in and out daily, for which I am not as familiar as he is. I do know the LBC can do certain contingencies, but they couldn't do them if it violated federal law and how the money has to be dispersed and to whom.
Representative Ledoux, do you have a follow-up, or would you like Bill?
Well, I just want to make sure that I understand the response, and then I'd like Bill to comment if he could. So you're saying that under the current law, it could do a contingency approval. So no approval or approval, but it wouldn't go into effect until the forestry receipts disappeared.
Through the chair, I'm not certain that's exactly what I said. What I said was there are certain contingencies that the Local Boundary Commission can put on a petition for annexation. However, I am not certain in this case that it could do a contingency, as you suggest, without the approval of the federal government, because that program is governed by the federal government. The forest receipts and who receives it is governed under federal law, not state law. And so I'm not certain that the LBC has the power to do a contingency, as you have suggested, that the land could be annexed into the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, but the forest receipts go back to the recipients that had been getting them, because it's no longer in the unorganized borough.
I understand that. That was my second question. But my first question was, could it do an annexation, but say that the annexation does not go into effect until the disappearance of the forestry receipts? Is that possible under current law? And that I don't think you'd need to ask the federal government about.
Through the chair, you know, I would have to look at the regulations, but normally to do a contingency, there has to be something in the future that you know is or isn't going to happen. I know in the past, like here in Juneau, they allowed an annexation of Greens Creek Mine, but did not have it go into effect for a very specific period of time. And after that period of time passed, it became part of the borough of Juneau. And that was in order to allow it to stay outside of the borough while it got up and running as a mine without having to pay a certain tax. And that's an economic development moratorium, if you will, that's allowed under state law. Without having an ability here, I'm sorry, to look at the regulations specifically to see if that type of contingency, that is an unknown, if you will, that they will go away or won't go away, the national forest receipts from the federal level, I'm sorry, but I can't give you a clear answer on that, but I could research it.
I would really appreciate getting an answer to that. Thank you.
For the record, we've joined by Representative Sisna. Good morning and welcome. Is it all right to use first name?
Yeah.
Bill, if you could respond to Representative Ledoux.
Okay. Representative Ledoux, the National Forest Receipts Program was established in 1908, and the state of Alaska has been participating in the program since statehood. And I believe as long as there are national forests in the United States, there will be a national forest receipts program, so it will be ongoing basically indefinitely. What we're looking at is possibly sunsetting in 1998 or 1999. Congress, in response to the downturn in the timber industry, particularly in the western United States, enacted what's called the Secure Rural Schools Program. So, and in Alaska, we were impacted by the closure of the two pulp mills during that time period under the Clinton administration. So instead of using the old forest receipt program, they enacted the Secure Rural Schools program. And what that did was that gave each state its three highest payment, the average of its three highest payment from 1986 to 1999. So they looked at Alaska's payments during that window and gave Alaska for this six-year period under the Secure Rural Schools Program its average payment under that program. So what we're looking at possibly sunsetting is the Secure Rural Schools Program. If that sunsets, we'll revert back to the previous National Forest Receipt Program. And that operates, what they do is they take 25% of the income that was generated within each national forest, and they return that to the state of Alaska to be shared with the counties or boroughs within that national forest. And under federal law, it's very clear, each county or borough, in Alaska borough and unorganized borough, the national forest receipt payment is proportional to the acreage of national forest within your boundaries. That's why with the annexation of Ketchikan, they're taking or removing acreage from the unorganized borough into Ketchikan borough. So that proportion of national forest lands is what affects the formula.
Representative Ledoux, follow up.
Okay, so could you compare the money that goes to the unorganized borough through the Secure Schools program with the amount of money that the unorganized borough is likely to get if it reverts back to the regular forest receipts program? Is there still a lot of money that's out there?
Representative or Co-Chair Ledoux, well, recent estimates, as we know, there's not much timber. Basically, the income within the Tongass National Forest was predominantly through timber stumpage fees charged to commercial timber harvesting. As we know, in recent years, there's been very little timber harvesting going on within the Tongass. There has been a new Tongass land management plan that's been unveiled, and I believe that calls for cutting approximately 100, maybe 200 million board feet a year. Recent estimates do show, though, that if this program is not reauthorized, the payment to the Tongass National Forest will decrease probably by 85% to 90%. For instance, this year, the Tongass National Forest, we received about $9.6 million to share with the boroughs, the communities here in Southeast.
Mm-hmm.
If that program is not reauthorized, that would probably decrease in the 90% range. But then again, it all determines in the future if timber harvesting picks up again and so on, it could go back up. But in the short term, if it's not reauthorized, we're looking at a significant decrease.
Representative Ledoux.
But it could go back up again.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Lynn?
Yes, through the chair. I think as a practical aspect, it would be pretty hard to go back and forth if we approved it on a contingency basis, said, well, if this happens, what happens if it happens, you know, 6 months from now or 12 months, do we all of a sudden, does the borough go away? I mean, that portion? From our standpoint, it may be a little difficult.
I have a follow-up question regarding forestry receipts. Forestry receipts, even though we're under, I'm hoping this is to Bill, the Secure Rural Schools program and how that funds are generated, it really drops into the state of Alaska's general fund. It's not a dedicated funding stream. Can you answer that, yes or no?
Co-Chair Fairclough. It's under Title 41 is the statute that governs the forest receipt program, and I believe it does establish a fund, but you're right. We receive the money. Obviously, it's subject to appropriation in each year's operating budget, whether we disperse those funds at all. But I guess we'd be in noncompliance with federal law if we chose to withhold those funds.
From supporting a rural school?
From distributing to the boroughs here, because the federal law does clearly say it's to be apportioned to those boroughs in proportion to their acreage of national forest.
So there's a formula.
Right.
Okay. Lynn, did you have a comment?
Not anymore. No, I think he pretty well covered it.
Okay. We're trying to have some maps put up. I know that was an issue before. So the maps are going up. Any other questions from committee members? What we'd like to hear, you outlined, Lynn, for us that the Boundary Commission is first subject to the Constitution of the State of Alaska, then governed by state laws, and then to implement those state laws, you're governed by regulations that are have been reviewed and adopted by Commerce. Is that Commerce would have been in charge?
The Boundary Commission, excuse me, adopts the Rome regulation.
And if you could identify your name.
My name's Jean McFerrin.
Jean, thank you. When we speak, if I don't recognize you by name, then there's sometimes confusion in being able to track who's speaking for the record. Thank you. Thank you, Jean, for that. Could you speak to us about the conditions that you look at or the criteria that the Local Boundary Commission uses in considering annexation?
Okay. First of all, does it fit into the, obviously in the Constitution, does it fit in the state regulations? And then there's something called the model borough boundaries that were set up many, many years ago. And if I may go over the map and kind of show you a little bit about how the, this was the, there's a lot of talk about what happened in 1998, 1999, and this was the boundary, the proposed annexation boundary as rejected by the Boundary Commission in 1998. And you can see, I hope everybody can see that. It cuts out Metlakatla, it cuts out Hyder, and it also cut out Myers Chalk. Then when we come up with the new proposed boundary, this little line right here is the existing boundary of the Ketchikan Borough as it stands today. This portion in here is the portion they want to annex. Now there was both Ketchikan and Wrangell, both had Myers Chalk and Union Bay in their proposal. After hearing from in our public hearings in Wrangell and then again in Ketchikan, we decided that, and the people in Myers Chalk, they identified more with Wrangell than they did with Ketchikan. So we drew the line down the boundary, basically the watershed of the Cleveland Peninsula. And it pretty well conforms to the model borough boundary, except that it does come down the peninsula on the watershed rather than covering Myers Chuck. So Myers Chuck, Union Bay, we decided belonged more with Wrangell than Kentucky. Otherwise, it almost conforms to the model borough boundary with the exception of Hyder. So it's really not a lot different other than the two exclusions.
If we could have you back at the mic, Representative Ledoux has a question.
What was the status of the secured or the secure schools program back in 1998?
I don't know if it even existed as the secure schools boundary, or excuse the whatever it was
1986
called.
1986 was when it started, at least according to what I wrote down. Is that not right? Bill, could you respond to that?
Co-Chair Ledoux, again, it's been in existence in statehood. The Secure Rural Schools, it was based on the three highest payments to the state during the window 1986 to 1999. So they looked at that time period and took the three highest years and averaged them to determine our payment under the Secure Rural Schools program.
Jean, you had a follow-up to that?
Yes, I think the Secure Rural Schools, that portion of National Forest receipts itself, though, was in 2002, if I remember correctly. In 1998, if I remember correctly, it was just the National Forest receipts program itself, which still will remain in effect. It's just the Secure Rural Schools Act that makes the big jump, makes the big leap that you see here.
Thank you.
Lynn.
Yes. I don't really have a formal presentation. I'm just kind of answering
that.
Questions. Okay.
So then I have a question then. Okay. Two things. Representative Newman and I spoke last night, and we wanted to understand the depth of the public testimony and the comments, how you reached out. We'd like to hear a little bit about that. And then I'd like to know why you're excluding a community that's right on, it looks like a border. I don't know if you've just pulled that out. So why?
You're talking about the Hyder exclusion?
Yeah. Is that right along the Canadian border?
Yes, it is. Yes.
So that makes no reason. There's no rhyme or reason for me to have that out. Why would that not be included?
Basically, the people of Hyder itself were very opposed to it. And since there was a lot of confusion about who was going to do the schools there, originally in 1999, the Canadian school system did the Hyder kids, if that's probably not the proper term, educated the Hyder kids. And then now it's under the Southeast program out of, I forget where it's headquartered out of, it's Prince of Wales Island somewhere.
Thorn Bay,
is it? Okay. And so that's why we put in the five-year. We wanted to give time for both Ketchikan and Hyder to come up with ways that they can merge the two together. And so we do actually have Hyder moving into the borough in a five-year span. If Ketchikan and Hyder don't agree to it, then we'd go ahead and do it ourselves. So there was some concession to the public input on that issue.
Thank you. Representative Newman had asked when we spoke last night about, we'd like to hear about your input. How many meetings did you have?
We had hearings in both Wrangell and Ketchikan all day. We went until 10 o'clock at night in Wrangell on a couple of occasions. And it was kind of interesting because not one single person opposed anything in Wrangell. Everybody was in favor. But when we got to Ketchikan, then it, of course, obviously flipped because the Prince of Wales people were very, very adamantly against it. So we did have testimony, obviously, from both sides. We heard hours and hours and hours of testimony, and then we made our decision after that.
Representative Newman, then Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you refresh my memory? Representative Coghill had a piece of legislation that dealt with how the local boundary commission makes its decisions. Did that legislation pass?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, no, it did not. It's still there. I think you're referring to House Bill 247, I believe.
I believe.
And it had dealt with a kind of a reorganization of the local boundary commission, but we're already a separate agency. I don't know why what that would really do other than probably impact a lot of because we don't have that many staff, but it would impact our staff more than anything, and it could leave them in a limbo situation.
Well, I'll tell you what it can do, in my opinion. I think it can help alleviate some situations like what we have here. A part of that bill had it so that if there's a vote taken, both areas being annexed and the areas to be annexed, both areas, A and B, would have to agree to the annexation instead of an aggregate vote. I believe there's three ways that the Local Boundary Commission now can annex areas. But they only use pretty much one, and that's the one that they decide on, that they've been using. It's what they say. Also, another part of that I thought was a crucial part of it was if there is any votes taken or anything like that, that there's at least two votes in each community, because quite often it's been my experience when I hear from communities that oftentimes very well-organized groups can almost flood the voting process and miscue, I think, probably what the whole of the public wants. And then after the general public finds out about it through the media, we hear about it as legislators about what the heck happened here kind of a situation. And so that's why I know I had proposed an amendment in there that says you need to have at least two votes, you know, or to go into areas like that to find out for sure. Just so that, you know, people are more informed, because that's ultimately what we want, is the will of the people to happen.
Right. Through the chair, if I may, I think you might be referring to, is it House Bill 31?
31.
31 that did, yeah, of course, pass. I misunderstood. I thought you were talking about 247.
Yeah. 133, I think, I'm hearing as the proper citing for the bill. Jean, did you have a follow-up to Representative Newman? Because Representative Sist is in line.
That House bill spoke to local action petitions. This is a legislative review petition, and there are no votes at the local level. It comes to the legislature rather than going to the vote by the people in either the annexed area or the area annexing. So you're the one who gets to review these types. This isn't a local option petition. This is a legislative review petition. So if the commissioner passes it, what they accept comes to you for consideration. It doesn't go to the vote at the local level. As versus what Wrangell is a local option petition. Once the commissioner approved that borough, it does go to the voters in that area for approval.
Thank you, Gina. If I might, I believe Representative Newman was saying he was considering a change to state statute to allow that. Representative Newman, you can certainly speak for yourself.
But just as far as this goes, you know, even if this comes to the legislature for us to decide and there isn't a consensus of the people taken in a way of a vote, I know what I've heard from the people in the area. I've got a stack of emails this thick from one group and not very much from the other. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Ledoux has a follow-up to this line of questioning.
I just wanted to comment that actually the emails that we've been receiving were not from the people in the area that is going to be annexed, because there are virtually no people. I don't even know if there are any people at all in the area to be annexed. The people that we're hearing from actually are the people who are outside of the area to be annexed, but whose local schools are going to be losing around $9.6 million as a result of this annexation.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. Representative Sisna.
Thank you. And this is just following straight along, because this is the conversation we are having. Sort of more on this subject, two questions. One is that you spoke about the hearing that took place with Wrangell and then with Ketchikan, mm-hmm. and you said that no one was against the annexation in Wrangell, but in Ketchikan it was a different picture. I'm wondering if anyone in Ketchikan themselves, in that proposed borough slash city, objected to the annexation.
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, I don't recall anybody from Ketchikan that was opposed to it. There might possibly have been, but I don't specifically recall that.
Okay, and then another part of this discussion, it seems to me that we have a very large unorganized borough, lots of land, and more extreme economic hardship on the part of the existing boroughs, and that this either has been or certainly may be something that happens in the future as well, that if in fact there are receipts of some kind that can be gathered by annexing more land, that could be something that happens. It might not be that. It might be some other economic reason. And at least that's what it appears to me to be part of the problem here, is that we're looking at two areas where there are real difficulties in covering just basic costs that are trying to protect their problem, mm-hmm. and to expand the ability to deal with tougher and tougher economic conditions. And so that may be a continuing problem. Maybe it's already happened. Has it? And how do you see the Boundary Commission playing a part in that?
Wow. That's a huge question. I wish I had every little single answer to that through the chair. I think that I would clarify one thing. I think that the amount of money that's lost to the Prince of Wales School is $1.2 million, I believe. And the $9 million that you quoted, that's the money for the whole area. I think that you know, under the original Constitution, of course, it was set up to encourage boroughs. And a number of the original boroughs were, if I may use the word, were forced on people, like Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau, and I believe there's a couple others that were mandated at the beginning. Basically, almost nobody had a say-so in it. Now we're getting a little bit less all the time. So obviously, when we're sitting down, we have to look at the original purpose of the Constitution in the state was that they do want boroughs. And so it encourages us to do what we've just done. But this Forest Service receipts thing obviously is a thorn. I don't want to say that it's minor, because having been in city politics for many, many years myself, I know that one job or one budget is very, very important, especially in a small community. So I don't want to downplay that. But it is about 1% of their budget over the overall school district in Prince of Wales. It's roughly a 1% drop. So we're not talking about a catastrophic drop in revenue. But that's something that the local folks have to, I don't want to pretend to say that I know what they should do in their communities. So it's going to be an ongoing issue. I think that you're going to see other cities in Southeast probably will come forward with petitions. But once again, we are acting on a petition from the area. We didn't come down to Southeast and say, we, the local Boundary Commission, demand that you do this. This was a petition from the local people, both the Wrangell and Ketchikan one, that said, we want to do this. Would you help us do this? And that's what we've done.
Representative Ledoux, follow up.
I've got two questions. With respect to, I think it's Hyder, the community on the Canadian border, mm-hmm. Did Ketchikan want to annex Hyder?
I believe they did not ask for it. You know, the original Boundary Commission back in 99, I think, was using that as one of the reasons not to approve it then. But I don't think that it was in their petition this time. But we actually told them, well, you got to. You can't leave. If you really look at Hyder, you can't just leave it there. It's an enclave that's off by itself, and we certainly are not going to give it to Canada. So you got to do something with it. And so the only logical place would be into Ketchikan Borough. It has to, because you couldn't have a borough, say, in Wrangell or Petersburg, annexing Hyder, which is not even connected. So eventually it's going to have to go there.
And what were the reasons that Ketchikan wasn't interested in Hyder?
I don't know if they actually, Jean, you might answer that a little better than I could.
Excuse me, this is Jean McFerrin. Because of the community of interest of Hyder with British Columbia, they're separated by the Cleveland Peninsula. It was communications, transportation, reliance on Canada for service, non-reliance. Ketchikan has, and perhaps Mr. Grant Erickson can develop it more, but And the commission has encouraged the development of communications and transportation with the Ketchikan area over the next 5 years, directed Ketchikan to come forward with a petition. If they didn't, the commission is going to direct the department to develop a petition to annex that area.
Representative Ledoux, follow up.
But that isn't necessarily a given. I mean, so that you don't have in this annexation, it's not a flat, okay, you can annex this area now, and 5 years from now, Hyder goes into it. It's 5 years from now, and you start back at the table again, and there's a discussion as to what happens with Hyder.
Yes.
If I make...
We'd identify ourselves for the record if I haven't...
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chairman. Lynn Crystal, through the chair for the record. We said within 5 years, so it could happen a year, 2 years, somewhere within that five-year period.
Representative Ledoux.
Is Mr. Brandt, the attorney from Ketchikan, is he on the telephone?
He is. When we finish this line of questioning, we have Peter Chapel Davis from Hyder online to ask the question about 1% of the budget versus, but who would you like to go to first?
I think I would like to go to Scott first.
Scott Erickson, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Representative Ledoux has a question.
I guess I'm just wondering whether or not Ketchikan would have gone through with this annexation if it was necessary to incorporate Hyder into this and pay for Hyder schools.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Ledoux, I can't give you a definitive yes or no. At the time that the petition was pursued in 1998, the LBC had come back and said, well, if you take in Hyder and Myers-Chuck, we'll approve it. And based upon protests of the folks in Hyder at that time, the assembly elected not to amend its petition to include Hyder and Myers-Chuck. From a financial standpoint, the borough could provide those services to Hyder, but whether in fact it would have elected to do so if that was the only way to get the petition passed, I cannot give you a definitive answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Representative Cisna has a follow-up.
Yes, and I think the Boundary Commission is maybe more where I'm looking at for answers to kind of a combined question here. The Hyder situation itself points to, in my mind, kind of a concern on the part of the Boundary Commission that there be a governmental, sort of a human governmental element requirement in annexation. And that, to me, seems to be something that kind of comes into this situation, because we're looking at expanding boundaries where there's a benefit that is specific to needing to annex the boundaries without there being a governmental need. And that, I think, plays a part in this, in my mind. In terms of the effect it has on what aren't actually, if you took the water away, they would be immediately joined. But it is really only a marine road that does separate the two islands. But at the same time, it seems that. Well, a follow-up on my other question. Ever before has this happened, that boundaries have been expanded in existing boroughs without there being any communities attached to those lands?
Through the chair, Lynn Crystal, Boundary Commission. I think there have been, but maybe not to this extent. We did has some small expansions in Wasilla and Soldotna recently, and I don't know if there was any people involved there. Jean is the one that's been around for such a long time at the Boundary Commission that she would probably have more answers than I would.
Jean McFerrin, actually, when you're looking at borough annexation versus city annexation, there are different standards that apply. Borough annexations don't necessarily imply that the area that's being annexed or even incorporated into a borough has any current or future need for government. I mean, if you read the Supreme Court decisions about what the Founding Fathers looked at in terms of encompassing, making regional government in Alaska, for example, the North Slope Borough, some of the contentions against the North Slope Borough was that there was so sparsely populated, how could anyone ever carve a borough out of that? And the Supreme Court said, you know, as long as you could travel by dog sled or whatever, and, you know, there were people that could actually communicate in that manner. But when you're looking at borough annexation, it is a little bit different than city annexation with regards to standards and the number of people and land being taken into the borough.
Okay.
Margie Vander might be able to expand on that a little bit.
Through the chair, I think the main thing I would want to comment on is that the framers in many spots in the constitutional minutes mentioned that the entire state eventually is to be organized into boroughs. And to do that, you are going to have to annex territory that isn't going to meet every little, you know, criteria that it's always going to have people, or it's always going to have some sort of revenue source, or it's going to be because of services. It's that the plan was is that this state eventually will all be organized into boroughs, so that you have huge regional governments, sometimes small regional governments, but a regional government basis. And they chose the borough over the quote unquote county because the borough has the concept of a little broader scale, because it's such a huge state. It isn't like we could, you know, draw it on a map and cut it into corners like Colorado looks, little squares. But that is true. It is truly based because the borough government concept is a regional government, and you're going to have smaller governments within it, your cities. Sometimes it's, you know, it's a unified, but other times you've got cities within it. So it depends on really the type of area and the type of government that the petition's concern and the type of annexation.
Thank you, Margie. Lynn, did you have a comment?
Lynn Crystal, to the chair. You know, I did. One of the things that we've been very lucky at in our state is we still have a few of the framers of our Constitution are still with us. And on at least three occasions within the last year, we have had two of those people, Mr. Coghill and Mr. Fisher, have been at our meetings, our various work sessions, whatever, and we've had a chance to question and ask what they meant by this portion of the Constitution. So we're still lucky in that regard. We have that. So we've based some of our, I guess that's how our mindset kind of works too, is that we have talked to those folks. We've been lucky enough to do so, and get some of the thought about how this was originally thought of when they did the Constitution.
I have a question offline. Peter Chappell Davis, are you with us?
I am here.
Peter, this is Representative Fairclough. I have a question regarding the statement that the $1.2 million for the Hyder School is 1% of your budget. Can you speak to that?
I can, in only brief passage. I've listened to the testimony from a number of the different administrators in the different school districts around Southeast Island area, the different schools themselves, and the numbers that I've heard as it impacts the individual schools, as I recall, seems to run anywhere from about 15% to about 39, I think, was the highest percent I heard in any one specific school. I don't know exactly how Southeast Island administers it. I do, however, know that when Ketchikan was talking at one point about taking over the school in Hyder, if that was ever to come to pass, their idea, they said, of taking it over was to put it on correspondence, which is much less expensive, and shut it. But anyway, if there's any more questions in that area, I'll try and answer them.
Peter, you haven't answered the question. So maybe you could go off net to your schools and find out the answer for the committee. The specific question is, and that's being cited here, is that $1.2 million that would come to the school district represents 1% of your budget. That is from administrators, so a range is not going to cut it for me. I need to know what impact those forestry receipts specifically have on the school district as a whole. And so if you could get that for the committee, that would help us determine the impact of the forestry receipts on the school system, which this committee is taking into account and has heard from Hyder.
I appreciate that. I do not have a second phone line here, so I can't call the school district while we're doing this.
I understand. I didn't mean now, sir. I understand that there's limitations to that. But if we could get that information the next time this is up before us in written form, that would be helpful.
Will do.
Thank you, sir. Jean, did you have a comment on that particular point?
Yes, I just want to clarify. The $1.2 million loss is for all of the school districts in Prince Wales Island and Metlakatla, the south of the Ned Island School District. It's not just for Hyder. Hyder's in the Southeast Island School District. So it would affect City of Craig, City of Kwok, all of the school districts on Prince Wales Island and Metlakatla, and Hyder's in Southeast Island. So it's all of those communities. It's not just the Hyder School District.
So if I could follow up on that, then it may be more of an impact to an individual school in Hyder as far as a percentage of their budget, but overall of the, could you please frame for us when you say that 1.2 million is only 1%, what do you mean by that?
Overall, the loss to the average loss to the school, to all of the school districts in that region would be about 1.1%. Scott Brandt Erickson might have the actual numbers in front of him. But it's an overall or average loss, I think.
We have a chart here. Peter, we may have a chart here to represent each individual school. So I would refer you to Representative Thomas's office to see if that's already been provided to us before you.
I don't have it in front of me, but thank you.
I see where they're getting the 1.2 million. We have a page. I'm trying to see just so that you know. I believe it was provided to us by Representative Thomas. And we have Petersburg, Craig, Wrangell, all the way to Port Alexander down with dollars in them. There was a question from someone. I'm sorry. Bill?
If I may just elaborate on that. That's the list I provided. That shows that 1.2 million, it affects every municipality, including municipal school districts, in the unorganized borough here in Southeast. So it's not just Prince of Wales. It affects, let's say, the Hoonah School District, Petersburg, Wrangell, Pelican. It also affects second-class cities in the unorganized borough. Forest receipts is restricted to schools and roads. If you're a second-class city in the unorganized borough, we provide national forest receipts to those cities based on the miles of road they maintain. So you'll see, for instance, City of Gustavus, City of Thorn Bay, City of Kaufman Cove, etc. Those are second-class cities. They're not municipal school districts, but they do get forest receipts to maintain their roads or help maintain their roads.
So a follow-up from myself, Representative Fairclough. Gene, what we're trying to ascertain is when you tell us there's only a 1% impact, that's a lot different than what individual public members testified to as the impact to their particular schools in the opposition. I would say what we heard at the last public hearing was a majority of people testifying before this committee was in opposition to the Local Boundary Commission's decision. So they did not want the annexation to go through. And so 1% makes a big difference, at least to this individual, that's what's affected versus what we heard in global numbers. And that's why I was asking Peter, please, I need some hard numbers so that I can truly measure the impact. Can you speak to that, Jean?
Yes, not nearly as well as if I'd brought all the information with me, but like I say, and I know it's a spreadsheet that we have in a court case that we could certainly furnish to you, but it's a composite. Some of them will suffer a greater loss. Actually, I think Petersburg and Wrangell will probably suffer the biggest loss. Heidelberg, I think because of their low student population, will probably be in the 2 or 3% range, but the 1.15 percent that we had talked about was an overall average of the loss to the school district, and we could certainly get that information to you as a follow-up.
Is that helpful to committee members? The percentage, am I trying to bear down on the wrong issue?
No.
Representative Ledoux, follow-up.
All right. I'm looking at this chart that Bill just sent over. And I'm seeing, okay, the Hoonah School, it looks like it's losing $74,000. So that $74,000 is just 1% of Hoonah School's budget? I mean, it seems like a pretty big chunk of change.
Co-Chair Ledoux, the list I gave you is that some total loss to the city of Hoonah, and being a first-class city, they get forest receipts for schools and roads, so that would be a combination of both their school money and their road money that they'll be losing. I did not break it out specifically for their school.
Okay, so that when Jean says 1% of the school's budget, there's a different figure for what percentage of the community's budget is going to be lost.
Excuse me, if you look at that sheet.
For the record, Jean?
Yes, this is Jean McFerrin. Over on the right-hand side, it'll show you the...
Okay, so Hoonah, for example, they're going to lose $74,000, but that's less than 1% of its budget? It says
percentage change.
Minus 0.9%. Well, maybe it's not that much in percentages, but $74,000 for a small community still looks like a chunk of change.
Yeah, Jean McFerrin here, yes. And I think that's what a lot of the people say, that, you know, in terms of numbers, that might not appear large to a lot of people, but to them it is significant.
Representative Fairclough, Bill has a comment to make.
I think it's being passed out.
I'm going to go make copies.
Okay. This is Representative Fairclough. Lynn, we've heard in public testimony last week that the Boundary Commission doesn't actually take into account the financial impact or the consequence of the decision. Could you speak to that? Because that is what matters, I believe, and to this representative. I don't want to speak for the entire committee, but that is where the questions are going, is that finance is making a difference to us, because the state of Alaska will, from some perspective, need to fill in the difference, because we don't want to see communities adversely affected by this, and communities not knowing whether the state will step up to that responsibility are very apprehensive to accept change because of that.
You're absolutely correct, Chair Lynn Crystal, Boundary Commission. You're absolutely correct, and we certainly do take that into account. We listen, and just as we take into lots of different factors into account. But the bottom line was still that we get back to the point where it's still money that's not guaranteed down the road, and so we're making a long-term decision here on the boundary. Once we approve this annexation, it's basically cast in stone forever for all practical purposes, and yet these receipts are not cast in stone. We don't know what they're going to be, and so we do not put as much emphasis on that as we do on other issues, such as state regulations and the Constitution, those kind of things. So it is down the road a ways on our list of considerations. But each one of us, I guess just like each one of you, has to go in our own mind and make our decision based on what we really feel. So it's not always a clear-cut situation.
Representative Ledoux has a follow-up.
Okay.
When are we going to know, actually, whether or not the secure schools has been sunsetted or not? I mean, we know it's sunsetted. When do we know when it gets reauthorized?
Co-Chair Ledoux, it did sunset one time. We got a one-year extension for FY08. In the last probably 3 or 4 months, Congress on several occasions has reauthorized the program, but it was attached to Iraq war funding bills or troop withdrawal bills that when they went to the president, he vetoed them. We had another close vote. It fell one vote short in the Senate about 2 months ago. There's a lot of bipartisan support for reauthorization. The president does have reauthorization in his budget that he just released at a reduced funding level. Senator Stevens was recently talking to some folks in Kaufman Cove and told them that he didn't think it would get the vote, or it wouldn't be voted on again probably till late in this federal fiscal year, probably August or September.
Representative Ledoux.
How many times has it been reauthorized previously?
Co-Chair Ledoux, it was enacted, it went into effect in 2000, and it had had the one-year extension for FY08. It sunsetted in 2007, so it's had a one-year extension, so it has not officially been reauthorized yet.
Thank you.
Jean?
Yes, there is I have a copy here, I only have one, I'll give it to you, but what the proposal is right now is less than what President Bush has proposed is less than half. It might not even be called the Secure Rural Schools Act. It might be called something else. But it would be sunset under this proposal, phased out in 3 years. So that's just not the original National Forest Receipts. That's still going to be there. But the Secure Rural Schools Act or some mechanism that's like that at his current funding level is less than half. And like I say, his proposal is to phase it out over 3 years. There are proposals that have attached it to energy bills. I think there was some even proposals to attach it to the Iraq war funding. All of those, the people who truly believe in this and what the purpose of the Secure Rural Schools Act is, just don't like that. So there's still a lot of maneuvering. So who knows what it's going to be in the long run.
Representative Ledoux, do you have a follow-up?
I've got another question. I'm not sure it's a follow-up. Would it have been possible for the Boundary Commission to say we approve this, and instead of saying that we'll consider Hyder again in 5 years, to say, and in 5 years Hyder will become part of the annexed territory, and to direct Ketchikan to keep the Hyder school open as opposed to a correspondence course?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Ledoux, I don't know. I guess you'd have to probably maybe ask the AG's office or something. I don't know what the legalities of that would be. I'm not quite, it'd be very cumbersome, but I'm not sure.
Representative Cisna has a question.
And this is a follow-up on Representative Ledoux's question. How many students are in the Heidelberg School? Because the state has a formula at which it keeps schools open, and I suppose that actually all schools have to follow that.
Hyder rather than Heidelberg, I presume you mean.
Hyder.
Yeah.
Oh, pardon me.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hyder has 15.
Sir, the question was not to you, Peter. Peter, the question was not to you.
I believe bring the number to 18.
Peter, unless you're recognized by the chair, please don't comment.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Crystal, or
No, I was just kind of, I guess we got our answer.
This is Jean McFerrin. There are 18 students at the last count, I believe, in Hyder.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
I'd like to ask Margie whether or not it would have been possible to simply direct the annexation in 5 years rather than to be reconsidering it again.
Co-Chair Ledoux, I think considering that Hyder is... What level city is that? I'm sorry. I would have to ask staff. Is it an organized city?
Yeah.
It is not an organized city. Okay. Since it is not an organized city, I believe, yes, it was probably possible to do that. However, I think that the petition itself, you know, it could be something that the Ketchikan petitioners could certainly object to themselves, because that is taking on something that was not anticipated. And it isn't part of the petition process, and I think that's the other thing, is that it wasn't included in the petition itself. So therefore you have an analysis that still needs to be done when you're going to take on something like a new school. And so it wasn't included in the original petition, and it would, under the regulations, need more hearings and input and analysis. So I think that is why, and I'm I'm going to speak probably beyond what I really know, because I wasn't at the hearings themselves. But knowing the regulations, it is something that would have to have the normal financial analysis and impact statements that the department does when a petition is submitted to it to see if it meets the minimum standards for it to go forward. And so that is why I think it needs its own petition in order to have its own information. But certainly it is now that the statute did change that allows the commission to do contingencies like this. That was certainly a proper act to do. But
thank you.
Thank you. And Peter, I apologize. We have many people online, and so if we have people just cutting into the conversation, the clerk cannot keep track of who's talking if I don't identify who it is. I appreciate, and we understand, and the committee knows that there are people from Hyder, Ketchikan, and other people online listening. So I did not mean to be short. I'm just trying to control the meeting and who's speaking.
Oh, no problem, Chairperson. I'm having really hard trouble hearing, so I'm not even always certain that I haven't been asked. I apologize, though.
Thank you for listening. We know it's important to your community and those that are listening today. Jean, did you have another comment?
No, other than the fact that I believe Hyder itself is opposed to being annexed by Ketchikan, and those were the comments provided. So I think they would, if the commission had attached that without having been part of the petition process, they would have been very upset. But they were very much opposed to the annexation itself.
I think we certainly heard from Hyder in our public hearing that they were in opposition to that. The issues that we were to discuss today that we have asked people to come by just to refresh the committee's memory was one, to understand the forestry receipts and the aspect of how that interplays with the communities that are affected by this annexation and their budgets, and how, at least from the public hearing that we've heard, that their communities would be impacted by not receiving those funds in the future. Are there any other questions from committee members on forestry receipts and understanding that interaction? I see none from committee members. I just want to clarify the question that I've asked, and that is that we've heard that overall 1%, approximately 1% is affected by the 1.2, and I think that the committee could use the additional information to understand that relationship by community as far as the government budget that's inside there and the school budget that's inside there, to look at that impact in a percentage basis on those particular school districts. Jean, is there a possibility that your department can provide that for us? Or
we can certainly work with the Department of Education and get that information for you. I would like to say that the Joint Legislative Education Task Force is also addressing the issue of the sunset of the Rural Schools Act, and are looking at that particular issue themselves, and are aware of the fact that the money might not be re-upped.
Thank you, Jean. I appreciate that. For this committee's deliberations, we need that probably sooner than they may need that, because Representative Thomas is on a time frame, and those communities are on our clock that is ticking for 45 days, and we've cut into that by 10 days at a minimum already. And so we need to make a decision, even if it's a no recommendation, to move it forward if we can't address the committee's concerns, or a vote no, depending on what the committee says. Jean, a response?
Yeah, I would just like to also say that the Ketchikan Gateway Borough will receive nothing under the National Forest Receipts Program, whether it's the Secure Rural Schools Act or just the regular National Forest Receipts, until FY10, which is July of next year, because of the way the funding mechanism works. Under the regulations for boroughs, it's the acreage in their borough, and that would not, as of September of that particular year. So, because if you don't disapprove this, it would not be in the borough until this fall, and then it would not take any kind of funding change itself would not be take effect until next year.
Thank you for that description. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Jean is the one I'm asking this to. Now, with the funds that were affected here, are these funds used in partial payment to the required $4 million in local contribution under the student funding formula?
No, they're not. They're not part of the basic need. They're separate from that.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Just to clarify.
Bill, for the record.
Representative Newman, this is Bill Rolfson. It does not play into the state foundation aid formula, but a municipal school district, when they receive their forest receipts, they can use it at their discretion to meet their 4 mil local equivalency payment. Some do and some don't, right.
Is that an important enough question, Representative Newman, that we need to break that down by community and make that ask? We're trying to move, again, as the chairman, we have a representative who is representing communities that do not support the local boundary commission's recommendation. If we support the local boundary commission, then we can take all the time we want to find out every answer to every question. But knowing that they're on a timeline and that we're trying to accumulate information for our question, in default, could slow this process so that if you support what Representative Thomas is bringing forward, we need to do due diligence and act, is my only concern. So I just lay that on the table and ask the question. Representative Newman, is that something that we need to know? And I think it's a good question. I think it affects my decision.
Madam Chair, no, I don't need to know that. It was, you know, certainly something when we're looking at this, the ability of local communities to pay the required 4 mil on the local in the school foundation formula, funding formula. Do I need to know that here to make my decision? It's just one very small piece of it. So no, I don't.
Thank you. If there's a way that we can get that information in short order before Thursday, that would be helpful for me. Representative Cisna.
Madam Chair, I'm still working on sort of some of what I guess are good government questions. The concern I have, just, and I heard it mentioned, it almost sounded like anecdotal, that the borough had thought of, if it annexed Hyder, of putting that on correspondence status rather than school status, does again bring up that issue of the role of a borough, and that in increasing land, it's my idea that in the Constitution they were, and that Mr. Crystal, the idea may have been in that, that in fact you're growing your borough so that you can grow your ability to give service to the people that are going to be coming into that area, and that in fact this is a growing state, and that I'm assuming that the land that's being increased has habitable areas that could very possibly become communities, have new schools, and that if you don't want to have schools in your community, and you're not annexing because of that, and I'm not saying that that's the case, but it does sort of tickle that that question in my mind. Do we have the kind of attitude about enlarging that is an attitude that embraces the responsibility of a borough to welcome new responsibility, to welcome service to people, because that's what the borough is, mm-hmm. I think. Can you answer? Yes. And there's possibly two.
Through the chair, Representative Cisna. I would hope that's the case. I sincerely do. I would hope that that's the case, that people do embrace the responsibility aspect of this type of a thing. And you have the control destiny aspect, where you probably want to control the destiny of your own area. You know, I'm going to probably massacre this name, but molybdenum mine that they've talked about years ago that looked like it was going forward until prices dropped. If that expands, there could be a small little community develop around that. I mean, I don't know. But I'm certainly hoping that any expansion of boroughs in anywhere, not just in Ketchikan, but they would embrace the whole aspect of what we're all about, our schools and our services and what have you. And as I understand it, Ketchikan already does provide quite a few services, the area that they haven't annexed, like the search and rescue and that type of a thing. They already do that, which that's just being a good Alaskan.
Yeah. I don't think that sounded like it was non-governmental, though.
Well, yeah, but the government supports the, it was a volunteer thing, but the government has an aspect of supporting that effort. They provide the land and the buildings and some money for equipment and stuff like that. So, and you know, there's a lot of talk about this is a big money grab, you know, by the Ketchikan Borough. And I, for one, anyway, if I for one second thought that that's what the purpose of this annexation was, I would not have supported it. I do not believe that is the case. After all, we're talking about this money grab was only amounting to $1.2 million on Ketchikan's budget. I don't even know what their budget is, but it certainly is a lot more than that. And so I really do not think this is a money grab in my own heart and mind.
Representative Assistant Jean.
I would just like to say that education is a mandatory borough function, and Ketchikan would have to provide, if there were students inside their boundaries, they have to provide education to those students. They don't have a choice. It's a mandatory function of all boroughs.
Madam, follow up on that
Representative
one.
Representative Cisna?
Does it require the same kind of service that if there's 10 or more, I think, is the number of students required in order to have a full functioning school in a community? I think it's that. Am I right?
Jean?
I'm trying to remember all of the things about education, but I think, yes, if there are 10 students or more, there's usually a school involved, I think. Pelican, for example, kind of been right on the edge sometimes about keeping its school open because of its fluctuating base. Scott Brandt Erickson might be able to, but the only person that I have heard say anything about a correspondent school are the people from Hyder. I have not heard that from the Ketchikan representatives themselves. I don't know what they would look at. The school is new. It was his, like in the earlier proceeding, the students were educated in Stuart, British Columbia. The state has built a school over there. I can't imagine that with 18 students that they would automatically be turned into a correspondence school. But like I say, I think that maybe you should ask Ketchikan that question.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Thank you. Did you want to ask Ketchikan that question?
Yes, I'd like to ask that.
Scott Erickson, are you online?
Yes, Madam Chair. With respect to providing educational services, we did not have a discussion at the assembly level, but amongst staff in our interaction with the folks in Hyder, the two lines of discussion that we had, one was, well, what sort of services would these folks like? And the other was, if Southeast Island School District has a school operating there and is doing that, the easiest method might be to contract with Southeast Island School District to continue providing services in the same manner. However, the educational services aren't something that the borough assembly can control. The school board and the school superintendent would make the actual decision day-to-day how to do it. The superintendent that we have currently has experience in rural districts in northwestern Alaska, and has commented that providing educational services in a remote environment is not new to him and would not be difficult.
Anything else, Representative Sista?
Thank you.
Thank you for those comments, Scott. Does that complete the discussion of the committee for information on education and those dollars? Some of the other issues that were brought forward to us had to do, and I'm leaving this one for the end, is the change in the application as it was made and denied previously. That was spoken to by the public from different, it was spoken to by Representative Thomas also, that in essence the same application is being approved today that was disapproved yesterday. And so speaking to that, I just have a question first. How often or was there any change in the Boundary Commission's composite at your board level between the two applications?
Madam Chairman, there was a complete 100% change. Nobody that was on the Boundary Commission then is on the Boundary Commission today.
So to make the relationship that somehow it couldn't have been just different people having a different understanding or a perception of their responsibilities in applying the law?
Madam Chairman, Lynn Crystal, certainly that's part of it. Different people have a different way of looking at things, just like different legislatures would look at things differently. But there also were many changes. There were laws that were changed. There were regulations that were changed. And so that's part of it. And also, as I understand it, there was a lot of political play took place, you know, 10 years ago. The staff was more or less directed to oppose it in those days. And so it's a little different today. Our staff this time around was given a free rein to give us their honest opinion, and nobody was directed to do anything. And so that's probably part of it. But there are a number of things under some of the changes, the Local Boundary Commission has some, one of the things is what was put in is different. Is it in the best interest of the state? That necessarily wasn't in the regulations back then. So there were some changes in a whole different realm of people. One of the things that this commission has gone on record of doing is that we do not look at the model boundary that was set up many, many years ago and all these districts are drawn in. We don't look at that as cast in stone. We look at that as a guide to go by. Now, obviously, we didn't change a lot from the model borough boundaries in this time, but we did change it a little bit. And that's our philosophy today, is that we don't necessarily think that the model borough is the only way to go. For instance, the Wrangell. In the model borough, Petersburg and Wrangell are one big borough. And we've in conjunction with the people in Wrangell and the people in Petersburg that didn't want to go together, we now have the Wrangell borough that's at least tentatively going to be approved here soon with a vote that separated. So we're not tied into the model borough boundaries as tight maybe as the other commissions have been in the past.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Just in closing then, we have a number of significant differences between a handout that I'm showing for those of you at home that can't see it that are on legal size paper. Would you like to cover those for the record so that those that are listening have an understanding of how this is different? The committee would like to understand.
Well, it would take me a little while to run through that, but I'd be glad to. Under the proposed areas of annexation, there were the original one in 1998, and it was 5,524 miles of land and water, and now it includes 4,701, which included the 191 around Myers-Chuck at Union Bay, but excluded the 205 around Hyder. Under the annexation proceeding 10 years ago, there were no respondents, and this year we had three from the Metlakatla Indian Community, City of Wrangell, and Peter Cafal Davis. Yes, ma'am.
Sorry, just looking around to make sure other committee members don't have questions first. Back to the first area on the number one. Can you speak to why, if you know why, under the 1998-99 annexation proceedings, that only 17.9 miles and 3.5 miles were considered, and on the 2006-2007 annexation proceedings, that 205 miles around Hyder were carved out?
I believe it has to do with the geography. We've kind of changed some of the things. We've gone to drainage areas rather than just drawing a line down the bottom of a mountain or something. Isn't that, Gene, is that the
yes,
correct way of looking at
it? Yes, McFerrin, it was the natural geography. I think that's Cleveland Canal that separates Hyder there. And Scott Brent Erickson could probably speak to it more directly, but I think that was the natural geography that they looked at when they were looking at, and they proposed a short-term exclusion as well, and that's what the department bought off and the commission did also, that they recognized that this was not going to be a long-term exclusion of the Hyder area from the borough. But it was more based on natural geography this time than just looking at the little community of Hyder.
Bill, is there any comment there on how that affects forestry receipts or if that's even playing into that?
Could you repeat the question, please?
I was asking why in the 98-99 proposal that only 17.9 acres around the Hyder community were excluded from the annexation proceedings, and now there's 205 square miles. Is there anything other than what Gene has just described as a geographic boundary being used versus just a community boundary?
Through the chair, yeah, there was no discussion directly related to forest receipts when they were discussing the area around Hyder.
Gene.
I'd just like to clarify that if I remember correctly, REAAs and city school districts on Prince Wales Island and Their national forest receipts aren't based on acreage. It's based on average number of students, average daily meals, I think, whereas boroughs are actually based on acreage. So for the Hyder exclusion, it doesn't affect, because theirs is based on the number of students in the Southeast Island School District, not on acreage, that they would be either excluded at this point or included, either one. It's the number of students they have is what helps run their national forest receipts.
Thank you for that explanation. Thank you, Lynn.
Okay. Do you want me to continue on?
Yes, and if you could, don't have to read every one of them. We certainly can read, but if you would enter the highlights for the record so that those listening can understand what you're presenting to us.
Okay. I guess the next one that really has kind of changed is the one, two, three, the fourth section down on page one there, where it was amended in 2002. There were two substantive additions, a provision about the best interest of the state, which I mentioned, and then a new procedure for legislative review annexation proposals. And so those are new. And then the under the Department of Education, there were no opposition from them this time, and they did oppose the one 10 years ago. Education at Hyder, back in 10 years ago, they were bused over to Stewart, British Columbia each day, so the state of Alaska paid British Columbia. Now, Hyder has its own school, and it's administered by the Southeast School District. And then I mentioned about the reliance on the model borough boundaries. We changed that significantly in that we think it's a more of a guide to go by, and we're a little flexible on that. Under the commission members,
Lynn,
you can see there with it.
Lynn, I have a question on that. Was that a change in regulation that you established, or just how did you codify that in any way as a commission?
That was in our regulations that we had a long couple-day work session here, what is it, almost a year ago?
You also codified it before that, excuse me, Gene McFerrin, and when they made their Skagway decision to create the Skagway borough, one of the issues was that Skagway belonged in the Haynes borough under the model borough boundaries. And the commission clarified what the model borough boundaries were used for. It was a tool, not this exclusion to the creation and formation of boroughs. So they also made the exception in case law before they made it clarification in how they were going to apply it in regulation.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let me move on. On the bottom of the second page, it was kind of, I kind of alluded to that a little bit ago, about the political pressure, if that's the correct word, was put on the staff back 10 years ago to kind of go this way, and we didn't do, nobody did any of that this time around. The staff was free to do what they thought was right, and they did. And then, under the national forest receipts, we've already discussed a lot of that. I don't know if you want me to go into that. But and then the LBC consideration of national forest receipts, we certainly did. We did look at it. It's I know we hear from people that say, you don't listen to us. Well, we did listen. We just didn't agree necessarily. So there was a difference of opinion on that, on the forest receipts issue.
Jean, did you have a comment?
Well, having been serving Local Boundary Commission for longer than Lynn's been on there, I would like to point out that the Local Boundary Commission has brought the issue of the use of national forest receipts to the legislature consistently every year in their annual report over the last 10 years. And then when the Department of Education and the Local Boundary Commission were required to study the issue of school consolidation in 2004, they also cited that as an issue in that report. So it's not something new that the Local Boundary Commission has addressed. They've been consistently addressing this over the last 10 years and bringing it to the legislature.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, Lynn. If I may, mm-hmm. I might add there is another chain as well. Jennifer Abbott in the audience today is the new unit supervisor of the LBC staff in Anchorage. She takes over from Dan Bockhurst. And so now that you put a face to the name. And so she's new as well.
I appreciate that.
The last one.
And that has created some conversation about Dan's involvement in the Ketchikan annexation, and I have intentionally not brought that up today because it's not reflected in the record that Dan has participated in anything, though there is certainly a perception in some communities by some individuals that there is a link there. Are there any questions that anyone has on that issue? It's not an issue that has raised inside of anything that I've reviewed as an issue. So I just put that on the record. I would also like to thank you, Lynn, Jean, Bill, make sure I say it right, Margie, for spending the early hours of your morning getting ready and coming into the Capitol so that we could be a better informed committee. We have created our own FUPA, per se, in that I have been notified that we have not put on Thursday's agenda bills previously heard. So this bill will not be before this committee on Thursday. It will be the first bill that is heard on Tuesday, February 26th, to come forward. So those of you that are listening via teleconferencing, that the bill will be back before this body. I have discussed this with Representative Ledoux, co-chair, and we will bring that bill back forward Tuesday morning and have that the first bill before us on the 26th. With that, I do appreciate the difficulty in bringing communities together to form boroughs, as is mandated under the Constitution of the State of Alaska. Representative Dahlstrom and myself are the benefactors of a forced incorporation, and I've tried to keep that particular conversation out of the dialogue. I am an elected official, represented and sworn to uphold the Constitution of the State of Alaska, state statutes and regulations as they go forward, and certainly understanding and being a policymaker who can change some of those laws, per se, and regulations, understand my authority and how that should be used there. I truly appreciate the magnitude of time and energy and conversation that you've put in to all the issues that are before the Local Boundary Commission, as well as the presentation of the annual report and some of the challenges that you face in implementing and reaching your mission. So whatever the committee decides with the information we have, you are appreciated. You are welcome in this committee at any time to raise issues. And with that, is there any comments from committee members?
Thank you for putting this together, and thank you again for everyone that came.
Really, thank you for those of you who signed on. The public hearing is open on Tuesday morning, so if there's anything from anyone who has listened, who has not testified before, you will be welcome to participate on Tuesday morning. For those of you who have already testified before, please, if there is something that you need the committee to hear, please send it electronically to either Representative Ledoux or Representative Fairclough's office, and we will make sure the entire committee receives that information. And if there are questions that we need to raise to address before we take this forward, again, phone us, email us, fax us. We do want to make sure that the decision we make has as much information as possible and understanding how this decision affects the community as well as the state of Alaska. With that, again, thank you for coming this morning. This committee is adjourned.